Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier. Read by Kerry Shale. At the first gesture of morning, flies began stirring. Inman's eyes and the long wound in his neck drew them, and so he came to yet one more day in the hospital ward. He rose and dressed and sat in a chair, putting the gloomy room of beds and their broken occupants behind him. All that kept his mind occupied was watching out the window and picturing the old green places he recollected from home. Inman was waiting for the blind man to come. Now that he had healed enough, Inman was determined to go out and speak to the man. Inman had taken his wound during the fighting outside Petersburg. He was classed among the dying and put aside to do so, but he failed it. After 2 days, they sent him on to a regular hospital in his own state. The doctors said he might live or he might not. They gave him but a gray rag and a little basin to clean his own wound. Mainly the wound had wanted to clean itself. It spit out a number of things, a collar button and a piece of collar from the shirt he had been wearing when he was hit, and a shard of soft gray metal. Inman had lain every day watching the blind man. The man would sit all day selling peanuts and newspapers. Inman watched the window as he ate breakfast, and shortly he saw the blind man come up the road. Inman went outside, and with the shuffling step of an old man, crossed the lawn to the road. The blind man was square and solid, and his eyelids were sunken where his eyeballs had been. Without pausing even for salutation, Inman said, "Who put out your eyes?" The blind man said,
"Nobody. I never had any."
"Well," Inman said, "there's plenty I wish I'd never seen." The blind man said,
"Come on, cite me one instance where you wished you were blind."
Where to begin? Inman wondered. Malvern Hill, Sharpsburg. But Fredericksburg was a day particularly lodged in his mind. So he sat and told the blind man his tale, beginning with the vast army marching uphill toward a stone wall. Inman's regiment was called to join the men already behind the wall. Lee and Longstreet and befeathered Stuart stood right there on the lawn. After Inman's regiment had formed up, they dropped down to the sunken road behind the stone wall. It was a cold day, and the mud was near frozen. Some of the men were barefoot. Many wore homemade uniforms in the mute colors that plant dyes make. The Federals were arrayed on the field before them, bright and shiny, in factory-made uniforms, new boots. When the Federals charged, the men behind the wall held their fire and taunted them, and one called out, "Come on closer, I want them boots." And they let the Federals come as near as 20 paces before shooting them down. The Federals kept on marching by the thousands at the wall all through the day, climbing the hill to be shot down. Inman just got to hating them for their clod-pated determination to die. Late in the afternoon, thousands of men lay dead and dying on the sloping field below the wall, and by dark the ones who could move had heaped up corpses to make shelter. The wounded Federals moaned and keened on the frozen field. The poorly shod of Inman's party climbed over the wall to yank the boots off the dead. The Federals were lying all about in bloody heaps, bodies disassembled. When Inman was finished, the blind man said,
"You need to put that away from you."
"I'd not differ with you there," Inman said. Inman returned to the ward, tired from his walk. He took up his book to read, the third part of Bartram's Travels. The doings of that kind lone wanderer never failed to ease his thoughts. Such images made Inman happy, and he found that he was forming the topography of home in his head. Cold Mountain, all its ridges and coves and watercourses.
Pigeon River, Little East Fork, Sorrel Cove.
He said the names like incantations to ward off the things one fears most. Some days later, Inman walked from the hospital into town. As soon as he was fit to fight, they would ship him right back to Virginia. He was careful not to look too vigorous in front of a doctor. Money had come from home, and a portion of back pay had been handed out, so he shopped in the red brick shops. Tired, he stopped at an inn near the domed capital and sat at a table under a tree. He drank a cup of brew, said by the tavern keeper to be coffee, brought in through the blockade, but it was mostly chicory and burnt corn grits. Inman commenced working on a letter. He found himself telling things he did not want to tell about the fighting. He wadded up his efforts and started again, and this was part of what he wrote.
I am coming home one way or another, and do not know how things might stand between us. I first thought to tell in this letter what I have done and seen, so that you might judge me before I return. But I decided it would need a page as broad as the blue sky to write that tale, and I have not the will or the energy.
Inman stood and doubled up the letter, then walked down the street to post it, and then back out to the hospital. After supper, Inman checked the packs under his bed. To the blanket and waxed cloth ground sheet already in his knapsack, he added the items he had bought. Inman fell asleep while it was yet gray dusk. He awakened deep in the night. Inman rose and dressed in his new clothes. He added his Bartram book to the knapsack. Then he strapped on his packs and went to the tall open window and looked out. It was the dark of the new moon. He set his foot on the sill and stepped out the window. Ada sat on the porch of the house that was now hers, a portable writing desk balanced across her lap. She wrote,
"This you must know, that despite your long absence, I will never conceal a single thought from you. I consider it a mutual duty to communicate in a spirit of the utmost frankness and candor."
She scanned what she had written, then balled up the paper. She looked off across the yard to the kitchen garden, where the beans and squash and tomatoes bore vegetables hardly bigger than her thumb. Standing thick in the rows were weeds that Ada had neither the energy nor the heart to fight. Since her father's funeral, Ada had hardly turned a hand around the farm. She had at least milked the cow, which Monroe had named Waldo, and fed the horse, Ralph. But she had not done much more, for she did not know how to do much more. Cookery had become a pressing issue for Ada. She was perpetually hungry, having eaten little through the summer but milk, fried eggs, salads, and plates of miniature tomatoes. She wanted a bowl of chicken and dumplings and a peach pie, but had not a clue how one might arrive at them. She had grown up in Charleston, and at Monroe's insistence had been educated beyond the point considered wise for females. She had become a knowledgeable companion for him, a lively and attentive daughter. But what actual talents could she claim? A command of French and Latin, a hint of Greek, a competency at the piano, the ability to render landscape and still life with accuracy, and she was well read. None of them seemed exactly to the point now that she found herself in possession of close to 300 acres, a house, a barn, outbuildings, and no idea what to do with them. For most of the 6 years of their mission to the mountains, Monroe had employed a white man and his part Cherokee wife to run the place, but now the hired people were gone. Since then, she had discovered herself to be frighteningly ill-prepared in the craft of subsistence, living alone on a farm that her father had run rather as an idea than a livelihood. She climbed the steps to her room. Ada took a book from her bedside table and sat in the stuffed chair. She had spent much of the past 3 damp months sitting in the chair reading, a quilt wrapped around her. No matter the book, the characters all seemed to lead fuller lives than she did. After only a few pages, she went down to the kitchen and prowled through the pantry for something she could turn into a meal. For dinner, she ate only a plate of the little tomatoes and cucumbers. She took a shawl and wrapped it about her shoulders, left the house, and went out into the lane. She walked down the lane a mile, and then she passed out of Black Cove and turned onto the river road. Ada reached the little chapel that had been in Monroe's charge. It was hardly more than a bird trap, but its proportions were decidedly spare and elegant. Ada went to the burial ground behind the church and stood before Monroe's plot. There was still no marker, Ada having rejected the local styles, either a flat river rock or an oak plank with the names and dates scratched faintly on the surface. She had ordered a carved granite headstone from the county seat, but it was slow in coming. She put flowers on the ground at the head of the grave. The day Monroe had died was in May. He had sat reading a book under the pear tree. As Ada walked into the yard, she saw that Monroe lay in complete repose. She walked up to wake him, but at a touch, she knew he was dead. Ada went as fast as she could for help to the Swangers' homestead. She reached their house, breathless and crying. Before Esko Swanger could return with Ada, a rain blew in. When they got back to the cove, darkness was falling and Monroe was wet as a trout. 2 days later, Ada had buried Monroe. 40 people, dressed in black, nearly filled the little chapel. The funeral service had been improvisational, since the ministers of the local Baptists had declined to participate in retribution for Monroe's failure to believe in a God with severe limitations on his patience and mercy. Monroe had, in fact, preached that he looked on both the best and worst of mankind with weary, bemused pity. So they had to make do with words from a few men of the church. Later they stood at the graveside. Another of the men led a final prayer. When the grave was mounded up, they all turned and walked away. Sally Swanger had taken Ada by the elbow.
"You stay with us until you can fix up things for going back to Charleston," she said.
Ada stopped and looked at her.
"I will not be returning to Charleston immediately," she said. "I will be staying here, at least for a time."
Mrs. Swanger stared, then caught herself.
How will you make it?" she said.
"I am not entirely sure," Ada said.
She had stayed on with the Swangers 3 days, and then returned to the empty house, frightened and alone. After 3 months, the fright had somewhat faded, but Ada reckoned her new life only a foreview of herself as an old woman. Ada turned from the grave plot and walked down the hill to the road and decided to keep on walking upriver. Ada reached the mill. She stuck her head in the door.
"Mr. Peake?"
she said. The miller stepped from behind the grindstones.
"Come for mail?"
he said.
"Is there any?"
The miller went out and returned with a letter. Ada stuck it into a pocket and walked on up the road to the Swanger place. She found Esko by the barn. He was tall and thin, with a tiny head and a great shock of dry, gray hair. He walked Ada to the house. Sally sat on the porch, threading beans on strings. She was shaped round in every feature, and her graying hair was hennaed. They sat together quietly for a minute. Their first talk was of the war, of how the prospects seemed grim. They would be glad to see the war done and their boys come walking up the road. Ada asked if there was any news from either of the boys, but they'd heard not a word in many months and knew not even what state they were in. The Swangers had opposed the war from the start and had until recently remained generally sympathetic with the Federals, as had many in the mountains. But the Federals were ranked up just over the big mountains to the north. Esko worried that they would soon come looking for food, take what they want, and leave a man with nothing.
"Them's the liberators," Esko said, "and our own bunch is as bad or worse. I just want my boys home and out hoeing the bottom land."
There was a pause, and then Sally said,
"Have you set on a course yet?"
"No,"
Ada said.
"You're not yet ready to return home?"
Sally asked.
"Home?"
Ada said, momentarily confused.
"Charleston,"
Sally said.
"No, I'm not yet ready," Ada said.
"Have you heard from Charleston?"
"Not yet," Ada said, "but I suspect that the letter I just picked up may clarify the matter of funds. It appears to be from my father's solicitor."
"Pull it out and see what it says,"
Esko said.
"I cannot bring myself to look, and in truth, all it will tell is whether I have money to live. It will not tell me where I might find myself a year further on, or what I might be doing with myself. Those are the questions that worry me most.
The clock rang out 4 chimes. Ada rose to go, but Sally made her sit.
Have you eaten today?
Sally said.
I had something,
Ada said.
Not much, I bet. I'll give you something to take with you.
In the kitchen, Sally went to a cupboard and took out a pottery crock of blackberry preserves. Ada said her thanks and asked Esko and Sally to stop by. She walked away carrying the preserves. Up toward Cold Mountain, then down into Black Cove, her house and her fields showed no neglect from this distance. With the jungle-like rate of growth here, though, she knew that if she were to stay, she would need help. She and her father had come to the mountains 6 years earlier in hopes of finding relief for the consumption that had slowly worked at Monroe's lungs. His Charleston doctor had recommended a well-known Highland resort, but Monroe instead found a mountain church of his denomination lacking a preacher, reasoning that useful work would be more therapeutic than reeking sulfur water. They had set out immediately. Ada had never seen mountains other than the Rocky Alps before, and was not sure what to make of this strange and vegetal topography. Monroe, though, was in high glee. In the weeks that followed their arrival, as she and Monroe visited current and potential members of his congregation, Ada discovered that these people were touchy and distant, largely unreadable. The houses were dark inside, even on a bright day. Rifles stood in the corners and hung on pegs. Monroe would rattle on at great length, introducing himself and talking theology and urging attendance. All the while, the men would sit in straight chairs looking at the fire, saying not a word. There were hidden people in the houses, women, children, and old people. It was as if they found the world beyond their cove so terrible that they might be fouled by any contact with outlanders. For that first year, Monroe had kept their Charleston house, and they lived in the dank little riverside parsonage. Then, when it seemed that the change of climate was working some improvement on Monroe's lungs, and the community was finally tolerating him, he decided to stay. He sold the Charleston house and bought the cove from the Black family. And he especially liked the house he had built there, largely because it represented his faith in a future that would include himself for at least a few more years. He assumed money would continue to flow from his Charleston investments. It apparently, however, would not continue, as Ada found when she read the letter. It was brittly phrased, cautious. It discussed the war, the embargo, and their effect on Ada's income, which would be reduced, in fact, to approximately nothing. She stood and thrust the letter into her pocket and took the trail down into Black Cove. Ada wondered where she might find the courage to search out hope. At the house, Ada took the lap desk and went to her reading chair. If she tried to sell out and return to Charleston, the little money she could hope to realize could hardly support her for long. She would, after a point, have to attach herself to friends of Monroe's in some mildly disguised parasitic relationship, tutor or music instructor or the like. That or marry. And the thought of returning to Charleston as some desperate, predatory spinster was appalling to her, particularly when all the men approximately her age were off to war. If she returned to Charleston under those humiliating conditions, she could expect little sympathy and much withering commentary. Their acquaintances thought that Monroe had shaped her into a creature not entirely fit for the society of men and women. There was therefore little surprise at Ada's response to 2 marriage proposals during her 19th year. She rejected them out of hand, explaining that what she found lacking in her suitors was a certain amplitude of thought, of feeling, of being. Return to Charleston was a bitter thought, and one that her pride rejected. She had no relatives closer than her cousin Lucy, no kindly aunts or doting grandparents. Outsider though she was, this place, the Blue Mountains, seemed to be holding her where she was. What she could see around her was all that she could count on. She sat at the window when she saw a figure coming up the road, a girl of sorts, a short one, thick as a chicken neck. Ada went to the porch and sat, waiting. The girl came up to the porch, and without asking leave, sat in a rocker next to Ada.
"Old Lady Swanger said you're in need of help," she said.
The girl was a dark thing, frail-chested. Her hair was black and coarse as a horse's tail. She went shoeless, but her feet were clean.
"Mrs. Swanger is right, I do need help," Ada said, "but what I need is in the way of rough work. I believe I need a man hand."
"Number one," the girl said, "if you've got a horse, I can plow all day. Number two, every man worth hiring is off and gone."
The girl's name, Ada soon discovered, was Ruby, and she convincingly depicted herself as capable of any and all farm tasks. Just as importantly, Ada found she was enormously cheered by Ruby. And like Ada, Ruby was a motherless child from the day she was born. In short order, and somewhat to Ada's surprise, they began striking a deal. Ada said, "Right this minute, and possibly for some time to come, money is in short supply."
"Money's not it," Ruby said. "If I'm to help you here, it's with both of us knowing that everybody empties their own night jar."
Something on the order of equality was Ruby's demand. Since no one else was lined up to help her, and since Ada had been tossing her own slops all summer, the request was fair enough. As they talked over the remaining details, Ada's yellow and black rooster walked by the porch.
"I despise that bird," Ada said. "He tried to flog me."
Ruby stepped off the porch and snatched up the rooster and pulled off its head. By dinner time, the meat of the rooster was falling from the bone, and gobs of biscuit dough cooked in the broth. Inman calculated that his days of traveling had put little distance between himself and the hospital. His slow pace had been at considerable cost. He was bone-tired, and at least partially lost, still trying to find a passway bearing directly west toward home. Vicious dogs and the threat of the home guard out prowling and the gloom of the cloudy nights made for nervous wayfaring. The night just passed had been the worst. He had heard the beat of horses cantering and had climbed a tree and watched as a pack of guard rumbled by, seeking out just such a one as himself to seize and thrash and return to service. That long night accomplished, having at last reached open country, he needed to move on. The sun climbed the sky and turned hot. In the afternoon, he came to a crossroads settlement. There was but a store, a few houses, a lean-to where a smith peddled at a wheel, sharpening the long blade of a scythe. Inman decided to risk going to the whitewashed store to buy food. Two men sitting on the porch hardly looked up as he mounted the steps. Propped up against the wall was a fine Whitworth rifle, an elaborate brass-scoped artifact. He walked past them into the store. From the store's meager stock, Inman bought 5 pounds of cornmeal, a piece of cheese, some dried biscuit, and a big sweet pickle, and then he went out onto the porch. The two men were gone. Inman stepped down into the road, eating as he traveled. Then, as Inman came to the edge of town, the two men came from behind the smithy and stood blocking his way. The smith stood watching.
"Where you going, son of a bitch?" one man said.
Inman said nothing. The other man moved off to the side. The smith, carrying the scythe, circled around. They looked to be layabouts, drunk maybe, and overconfident. Inman had begun to reach for his pistol when the three jumped as one, swarming at him. Inman jerked the scythe from the smith's hands and went at their feet, mowing at them. The men dodged about, but soon they swarmed again. Inman eventually smote the three down to their knees with the staff. The smith rolled over and pulled a small caliber revolver and began drawing a shaky bead on Inman. Inman said, "Shitfire." He palmed the little weapon away and stuck it to the man's head and commenced pulling the trigger out of sheer frustration. The caps, though, were faulty, and he gave up and beat the man about the head with it and flung it onto the top of the building and walked away. Outside of town, he turned into the woods and walked, roadless, to elude pursuers. For course setting, Inman had the sun wheeling above him, and he followed as it slid off toward the western edge of the earth. As Inman walked, he thought of a sermon of Monroe's.
"That
which shows God in me fortifies me. That which shows God out of me makes me a wart and a wen. There is no longer a necessary reason for my being. Already the long shadows of untimely oblivion creep over me, and I shall decrease forever.